The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Hello and welcome to the Yes for Life show. I'm Robin Daly, and today's show, as usual, will be all about integrative medicine for cancer. I'm visiting one of the longest standing clinics in the UK that offer people with cancer approaches that are not included in conventional healthcare. High Tree Clinic in Uckfield, Sussex, is headed up by Dr. Siegfried Treffser, who's going to tell us about the clinic and his work there. Okay, so I'm here in the reception at High Tree Clinic with Dr. Siegfried Treffser. Hello, Siggy, nice to see you.
Hello, Robin, nice to see you.
I haven't visited you here before. Last time you're in another premises. So I wonder if we could just have a little walk about and you maybe just talk about what you do in each of the spaces.
Yes, thank you for coming down to see us and show you around. The clinic was relocated 2 years ago from different premises, bigger premises to slightly more condensed, smaller premises, but more purpose-built. And I show you around. So we're
great.
Standing here at the reception area. And I have two consulting rooms here at this clinic, one of them also a treatment room. And I have a larger communal treatment area where patients who decide they want to be treated in the communal area often sit together, for example, for treatments having such as intravenous treatments. But the concept and the model of this is that patients during the time, while these treatments are time consuming, and during that time they can also share information with each other. It has a medical treatment effect, and it has a social aspect which is different from just sitting in the waiting area of a GP practice. When patients receive their treatment, they often feel in a relaxed state. Treatment is underway, and they have time to share important information and give each other encouragement or criticize the doctor together if they want. But it has been a very useful model that we have explored over years, and most patients agree to be treated in a communal area.
Interesting.
They prefer, very few patients prefer to be treated in privacy. We have such patients also, and we give them the option.
Yeah. Okay, great.
So I show you perhaps the maybe the consulting area first.
Well, all right.
This is a consulting room. My initial assessments, a patient comes new from traveling from sometimes quite far, so they're often distressed, they get a drink, fill in some forms, then they see myself in an agreed appointment time that could range from 20 minutes to 2 hours, going through medical reports, going through tests and clinical examination procedures to establish whether we are the clinic to help them further along. Or where else might be better for them, in which case it triggers a referral.
What's a typical, say you're having a first consultation, a new patient, you're really getting to know them, what's a typical length of one of those?
Yeah, some patients come, they just phone us up with an acute problem. They, for example, can't see a GP locally, they have a chest infection, or they have a feverishness, or they have a skin rash. And they phone us at short notice to speak to a doctor, to be assessed, perhaps if needed, to have a tests or blood tests, or just to have reassurance, or to have treatment strategy indicated or pointed out to them, or to just calm them down that it's nothing very serious, and that may just take up to 20 minutes or half an hour.
Right.
We don't have so many such patients. Most patients come by prior appointment booking. They come from often quite far from being recommended to us, as we have a reputation for treating chronic illnesses or conditions that fall in between various medical specialties. So patients often look for a clinical coordinator to guide them in which sequence they should seek, for example, specialists or avoid specialists.
So it's a very important function.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a coordinator function that I see myself doing. Perhaps this is my background is general practice for many years, having worked also for many years in out-of-hour services and having spent a lot of time in NHS hospitals, where I'm still currently under contract for treating chronic pain conditions, musculoskeletal problems, patients with facial pain, back pain, skin disorders, autoimmune diseases. So this is my sort of NHS activity that I carry out in London, and at this clinic here, this is non-NHS, and patients fund their treatment and their appointments themselves.
Right. Okay.
We have a second consultation area, for example, where if another complementary practitioner who fits into the spectrum of what we're doing works alongside myself. They work in this second treatment facility. Here we have a number of treatment options available, like in a hospital suite. They, for example, can access oxygen treatments.
What type of oxygen treatments?
We use pure oxygen as it comes licensed under the British Oxygen Society for treatment of hypoxic conditions, which can be just assessed by pulse oximetry or clinically. But many chronic conditions, like degenerative chronic conditions, for example, macular degeneration, patients with chronic bronchitis, patients with chronic fatigue, they often benefit from having oxygen treatment given directly intravenously by a very specific method that delivers oxygen at a very precise flow rate and at a very precise predetermined volume over a certain length of time.
So for this, the blood's taken out, oxygenated, and re-injected. Is that how it works?
This is one option that we also practice. So there are two or three different options of how oxygen is enriched in the red blood cells or is enriched in the bloodstream. The administering routes are there are various options of how to technically do this in a safe way.
Okay, and so you've got some other bits of equipment in here, I can see.
Yeah, we also use treatment called hyperthermia.
Mm-hmm.
Hyperthermia, as the word says, is the heat applying of focused or general heat to the body in a relatively precise way using infrared. There are different technologies we use. Infrared A frequencies to heat up either the body surface or 1 inch deep by focal heat transducers or devices that that, for example, heat up a lymphatically congested area or a painful chronic restriction joint, back pain, old injuries, injury areas, or local tumors benefit from the infrared applied.
Right, so that's focused onto one place.
It's focused onto one place. Hmm. Over a certain length of time, the infrared has a capability of opening the blood capillary system.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if patients have treatments, whether nutritionally or intravenously at the same time, this allows the therapeutic substance to pool into the treatment area that requires it.
I see.
It has a pooling effect.
Hmm.
And it has also a local vasodilative effect, of course, by taking away metabolites, tissue metabolites like lactic acid. Or even perhaps stored away toxins, sometimes metals even. To be part more integrate to integrate the troubled area more in within the circulatory system of the rest of the body.
Right.
There's also a treatment that we use, a treatment variety or option that is full body hypothermia, which is just a modern technical exploitation of the well-known tradition of using fever range hypothermia, like heated body conditions, to fight certain chronic illnesses.
Hmm.
The body does it naturally by itself by creating a feverishness. Modern medicine tends to suppress it, which is probably a safer way of doing it. To a certain degree, it's acceptable to accept temperatures and to allow the body to mount an immune response that is that it, its own endogenous immune response to certain pathogens.
Mm.
This is also used as a treatment concept in cancer treatment, as an adjunct treatment to many cancer treatment concepts such as chemotherapy.
Mm.
Where many studies have shown that the dosage of chemotherapy drugs can be optimized or reduced by the simultaneous application of hypothermia, full body hypothermia treatment. Mm. This will allow better tissue penetration or allow higher levels of the vasoactive therapeutic substance to arrive at the critical location where it matters, but also allows more immune competent cells to reach the target tissue.
Mm. So improved effect, but less toxic.
Studies have shown that the same effects can be achieved by reducing chemotherapy drugs and giving hypothermia at the same time, so that you synchronize both treatments to achieve equal outcomes with less side effects.
So the piece of equipment here that you're actually using for this would be described as a kind of tent, if you like, made out of silver fabric, reflective fabric, and the patient lies in this for how long?
Patients spend time in a hypothermia reflector tent for maybe 2 hours or 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on what the target temperature is that one wants to achieve, the target core temperature one wants to achieve. Some patients tolerate heat very well, in which case we can go higher, up to 40 degrees, and expose them to heat longer. Other patients, we have to be more cautious and careful and go with their tolerance of this treatment.
Right.
It's also used for rheumatoid conditions, for Lyme disease-related illnesses. And is understood also as a detox reaction to activate sort of skin compartments, outer skin compartments, to detox, to sweat, a bit similar to a sauna. But it's a more therapeutic clinical environment and monitoring under which this takes place.
Mm.
So this area is an area has restricted access to patients and the public. Where we store our medicines and prepare our our therapeutic regimes, which are of a very different variety. They include injectables, they include oral preparations, they include intravenous preparations, and they are put together here by mostly by myself mm-hmm. or someone qualified to mix drugs and to prepare drugs and to prepare infusions. The product range runs from nanoparticle medicine, the old-fashioned word was homeopathics, homeopathic preparations, to use of trace elements or micronutrients, to also use of macro substances, macronutrients, electrolyte infusions, etc., for balancing the fluid compartments of the body. That another word is homeostasis, and that is the regimes are guided by tests that we do here, diagnostic tests. These include tests for deficiencies or tests for immune dysfunctions that require such interventions.
Mm. Okay. So we're coming into a bigger area here with lots of chairs. This is where your communal treatment happens.
This is like a communal treatment area.
Okay.
Where patients undergo treatments that often require a certain amount of time, maybe between 1 and 3 hours on average. They sometimes can be one singular infusion or can be a combination of infusions that are prescribed on an individual basis. And such treatments, for example, are detox programs, and some are immune boosting treatments, some are immune balancing, including oxygen, the use of oxygen treatments also.
Mm. So I'm in the treatment room and I'm talking to
Achilles.
Very nice to meet you. Here we are in Britain. We've got free health service, free to all. You're in a private clinic here. Why?
After I finished my treatment in Germany, I wanted to move to England. And I had to continue some infusions.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of the very few places I was suggested to.
Right. Well, that's right. There are not so many places in Britain that give you infusions. Unlike Germany, where it's relatively easy. Yeah,
so many full.
So you've had treatment at a German clinic?
Yeah.
Yeah, a particular one? Can I ask?
The second time was Hoferland.
All right. Okay, Hoferland Clinic. Very good. And can you give me an idea of the kind of treatment you were having there?
Yeah, I had low-dose chemo.
Yeah? Okay.
Insulin
potentiated?
No, this time.
Just
the first time.
Right.
In Hoferland, they don't do IPT.
Okay.
So just low-dose. Hyperthermia.
Yes.
Full body and local.
Mm-hmm.
And many sort of infusions.
Right. So these things not too hard to get in Germany, but very hard to get here, some of those.
Yeah. And some others impossible.
Yes. But nonetheless, you're following up now with more infusions here.
Yeah.
And do you think, I mean, you're in mid-journey, but do you think what you've done has helped you?
Well, the first treatment I had when I was diagnosed has helped me much more. I had much better results.
Mm-hmm.
The second time didn't do too much.
All right.
Only blood work wise. Otherwise, the lymph nodes, because I have Hodgkin's.
Hodgkin's lymphoma, yeah.
Yeah. The lymph nodes didn't shrink.
Right. It's unpredictable business, cancer, isn't it?
You never know. But the second time I was already feeling good.
Mm-hmm.
So didn't do much to me.
Right.
First time I wasn't feeling so good.
You were starting from a low point.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay. And so, do you anticipate coming to the High Tree often? Are you?
Yeah, I come here twice a week.
Oh, you do? Right. Okay. So you're on a a program of intravenous vitamins.
Yeah.
How long have you been having treatment for your lymphoma? No, overall.
In general. I was diagnosed January 2017.
Okay.
So I started treatment the next February.
Right. And you feel you're becoming a bit of an expert on your condition? If You learned a lot?
I've learned a lot of things, yeah.
Yeah, it seems to be
But it's all subjective, I mean. Everyone is different and you will hear both sides in everything.
Mm-hmm.
From diet to drugs to whatever.
All right. But you must have developed some reasonably clear ideas about the good directions for yourself and ones that aren't so good.
It depends on the results. Every time is different.
Mm.
I mean, the second time I didn't have the best results, but it was different drugs. It was different type of administration. First time was IPT. Some say IPT is better, some say no.
Right.
You never know unless you get the results.
No, that's true.
Something that you works for one person might not work for the
another. And something that works at one time might not work another time. Yeah, it's very tricky. Anyway, really interesting to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, back in your consulting room here. And so, I think I'm right in saying that this is an auspicious year. The 10th anniversary of the High Tree Clinic. Would that be about right?
Yeah, it's about right.
Yeah.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, so those with a long memory will know that when you established the clinic, you were filling a space that was occupied for many years previously by Fritz Schellander, the Liongate Clinic, and he retired at that time. And so I was interested, what inspired you to take the massive step of taking on this huge task? You could have probably earned a good living doing something much simpler and less challenging than running a clinic, giving people unusual therapies for chronic disease.
Yeah, thank you. I provided complementary medical treatment years before I met Dr. Schellander, who ran a successful practice in Tunbridge Wells, and have included in my repertoire of treatments Chinese herbs, mm-hmm. Western herbs, homeopathic preparations, and a range of musculoskeletal treatment interventions which I've studied at various osteopathic and musculoskeletal treatment facilities here in the UK. And I have often used this in general practice in the NHS. And there were many patients at the time which could not access what myself and colleagues have provided. And therefore, they wanted to see us outside the conventional NHS access routes. So I had to practice an established practice already before I met Dr. Schellander. Mm. But when I met Dr. Schellander around 2006, he was particularly keen that he could identify a successor to his practice to allow him to retire. This explains in itself that he was very committed to the treatments that he to some extent pioneered here in the UK, and the success stories that it has created, and a huge number of patients anxious for the treatments to be provided and to continue.
Yeah, he was fulfilling a very important role, wasn't he? At that time, yeah.
And so I understood this, and I took the plunge and took over some of his treatment concepts, including trained staff who were operating these treatment equipments. And from that moment, the volume of my practice perhaps didn't double, but it suddenly increased in size and
right.
And commitment requirements. And so this is how it's High Tree Clinic was catapulted on a higher level of
right.
Efficiency. Mm. I would call it.
Mm. Mm. Okay, so I'd like to talk a bit about what you see as your objective with patients, and obviously there's lots of objectives for different patients and different conditions, but if you were to give an overview of what you're trying to achieve and how you're trying to achieve it, how would you describe that?
Cancer is, as I see it, treatment of cancer conditions is is a highly political subject. I'm not an oncologist myself, but I treat patients who suffer from cancer and have many side effects, have many additional diagnostic requirements than what the current system can offer.
Mm-hmm.
So our clinic specializes in overseeing treatment options that patients themselves decide based on their own research and on publicly available research material to optimize their treatment programs and to bring in additional treatment options to their often existing or pre-existing treatment strategies.
Right. So you're bringing the level of expertise that they need in order to pursue their own aims.
Correct, if I can call it that. It's something that has grown over the years and is constantly evolving. I do not consider myself as the ultimate expert in this field. It's a vast area of research data coming in every day. Clinics providing pioneering treatment concepts worldwide, and in the global environment in which we live nowadays, patients put considerable pressure on therapists to provide treatment options or to network in a certain way to optimize their care. And there are many self-help books to encourage patients also to be to some extent and rightly so very selfish and to to push doctors and therapists to act on their behalf. I personally find this rather stimulating.
Right. A lot of oncologists don't like that kind of thing, though, do they?
At the same time, one has to check, you know, that there's a safety aspect. There's not only the pioneering aspect, there's also the safety. Do we have enough safety data or information? Also the regulatory environment in which we live not necessarily prohibits, but requires caution and requires a huge amount of accountability for what is done in clinical environments.
Right.
So we therapists often in the middle of these pressures,
right,
and see ourselves in a tricky situation. We are. We'd like to help. Most of us are compassionate human beings and can identify with the suffering that patients go through. Some of us are researchers who would like to bring in innovative ideas. But we also are reminded by the regulatory authorities to perform within a certain standard and within certain restrictions and limitations. So it's a
balancing act.
It's a balancing act, a juggling act, and a balancing act. And often patients don't want to hear the pressures that we have to encounter and are governed by. And it needs often a lot of explaining to do before anything can happen.
I imagine
it can happen.
So you know, you were just saying that medicine now is really, it's on a world stage, isn't it? Which is not true. A few years back, it was very much we were doing our own thing in Britain, but now there's an awareness of what's happening all around the planet, both by practitioners like yourself and also by patients. So the understanding of cancer, how to control it, is all progressing increasingly rapidly. So I imagine that. Whereas some tried and trusted methods are still in use, like they were when you first set up the clinic, some other new approaches will have arrived on the scene, and some will maybe have fallen out of use in favour of more effective options. Could you tell us maybe what you feel are the most important developments of the last decade, both in the worldwide scenario and also here at the Hightree Clinic?
Well, the tried and trusted treatments for a long time, they consisted of the triple treatment combinations, often involving surgery, chemotherapy, and radiotherapy. Mm-hmm. But the modern concepts within oncology are now very different. There has been a huge amount of innovations of research data that shows that the standard chemotherapy regimes have, according to many meta-analyses, only provided a certain type of benefit or a certain percentage of benefits, which were perhaps over-exaggerated for a long time. But with the arrival of innovations of also engaging the innate immune system in the own cancer recovering program has led to a number of treatment strategies that are now considered intelligent and more superior than the pure cytotoxic treatment intention.
Mm-hmm.
There are often, like with any innovations, there is the accessibility, the funding, these are often limitations that we encounter. Patients for that reason travel to other countries to access them cheaper or quicker. The difficulty that remains then for clinics like ours is to find ways of giving patients access to these treatments, but at the same time to warn them if there are dangers involved, cost implications, and also what happens to some extent after such treatments.
Right.
One of the complications is that it's not only shrinkage of tumors, it's not the only concept, it's also patients want to live long with their diseases and would like to have a safety net that works for them afterwards.
Mm.
There are now more and more cancer survivors in the UK than ever before.
Right.
But there are not enough concepts in place currently that care for them adequately.
Mm.
It's a huge cost implication. Oncology departments are overwhelmed by cancer survivors who are not free of symptoms. They have often complex care needs afterwards, successful treatments, complex care needs, which often overburdens GP practices with a lot of jargon, but also with a complexity of providing diagnostic certainty for such patients, and then it needs clinics and practitioners who have experience in this, who can who understand the side effects of treatments, who understand that not every pain is cancer biting back somewhere within our anatomy. It's often just pain that is related to, for example, osteoporosis, post-radiation fibrosis, etc., etc. These tissue reactions have to be understood and have to be taught and have to be treated with adequate knowledge.
Mm.
And the intention to minimize more expensive diagnostic tests just for the sake of excluding cancer coming back. It's often just there's a need to treat symptoms.
So it's almost like a new branch of medicine, really, isn't it? Which is like looking after people who've had orthodox therapy and are now suffering the after effects. Yeah.
Correct, yeah. Mm. And it also involves nutrition and depletion of nutrients, often after chemotherapy or radiation has limited the amount of surface within the digestive system to absorb nutrients.
Mm.
So there's a huge number of nutritional implications, often as a consequence of intensified treatment programs.
Right. And so looking at your clinic, as far as I remember, you were doing hypothermia almost on day one, and you still are, so that would be the tried and trusted here, which is still going on. Are there other things which you've done consistently all the way through, and are there also things which have either disappeared or arrived during the decade?
Yeah, the use of oxygen treatments, it's... They use it in sport. It's used widely used in sports medicine, but it's perhaps underused in boosting the recovery rates for chronically ill patients. And the awareness of breathing, of balancing carbon dioxide and oxygen and nitrogen is an important aspect of every treatment program. I think the environment in which we live, that includes being exposed to environmental factors such as pesticides, metals, radiation, Wi-Fi, excessive Wi-Fi that we cannot escape in our office environments. These all have a serious impact on our immune system that works in a very subtle but highly coordinated way. And to identify such toxins, it has become increasingly important.
Right.
In a number of cases, I've seen the modern trends of using tattoos and cosmetic interventions as having an effect, for example, on the lymphatic system. So when there are trends within our modern ways of life that that could have also an impact on the increase or on the susceptibility towards certain chronic diseases, cancer and degenerative cell phenomena, as a typical example.
Mm-hmm. So in that instance, to do with detecting and treating those kind of burdens of toxicities, the testing has obviously changed a lot in a decade, hasn't it? It's very much more sophisticated now than it was when you started this clinic.
Yes, certainly. The testing, the laboratory technology has advanced so much. It's incredible what's out there in terms of technology. It's almost we clinicians are lagging behind in accessing that in an intelligent way and in a cost-effective way to give us enough guidance on how to treat illnesses. But it also allows us to identify causes that previously were unheard of, and many diseases like motor neuron disease, multiple sclerosis, neurodegenerative diseases, Alzheimer, etc., are just the final diagnosis of many different causative factors, and to identify such factors and the offending components has been very useful, and lab technology has helped us a great deal to advance our understanding. However, it's expensive.
Yeah, that's always the flip side of it, isn't it? If it was dead cheap, of course you'd be using everyone you could get your hands on. Yeah. But the price tag does add up. Okay, so you're from Germany, as was Dr. Schlander, of course, and the environment for practicing in the way you do is entirely different in Germany. It's 100% more accommodating, I'd say. Whereas you could arguably describe the healthcare environment of the UK as fundamentally hostile to innovative or unconventional ways of working. In Germany, doctors have got the freedom to practice as they see fit in the best interests of their patients. So, two questions. Firstly, what made you want to work in the UK rather than Germany? And secondly, do you feel there's any connection between the restrictive UK environment and the appallingly poor cancer statistics that we have here?
Yeah, to answer the first part of your question, the UK has a tradition of being highly respectful to folk medicine and to naturopathic traditions. It's in the kind of folk soul here, and I was in my student years was attracted by a number of such locations and venues where this was established at a very high standard, and one of them, as everyone knows, the Royal London Homeopathic Hospital, which was the only state-run establishment in Europe to provide complementary medicine. I was for many years a doctor highly involved and studying and learning such concepts. But there has been a shift over the years where these holistic or integrated concepts, which are very hard to pin down by the criteria of evidence-based medicine, to give them a place they deserve, with the shift of such goalposts, the environment has become increasingly restricted and more difficult, to the detriment of many patients who cannot be treated by the pharmaceutical model of modern healthcare only.
Right. So you're partly answering the second part of the question there, in that you think that it is to the detriment of patients that we don't have a broader view of what cancer care looks like.
Yeah, when you say we, I think I often feel patients have a broad view,
mm-hmm.
And have a broad interest, rightly so. But I think health planners who have to budget for everything and have to provide guidelines find it very hard in the modern regulatory environment that tries to follow other models of service providers, for example the airline industry, using a concept of safety and checklist consciousness to provide excellent care. But excellent care is not only a checklist awareness. Compassionate care is a lot more.
Right.
It's a lot more. And it requires not only the study of guidelines and databases that give us statistical outcome figures. It requires, I cannot say this in one sentence, but it's a different care model, and this is this is now increasingly challenged in the sort of modern debate on what healthcare should look like. And there are other countries who provide different care models, or slightly different care models. And I think it's worth looking at the sort of comparative outcome figures and patient satisfaction scores to perhaps guide us into the next stage of where we want to go.
That would be good, wouldn't it? Rather than just saying we've got the best healthcare service in the world, which is the old way of battling on. Yeah, it's interesting. Well, the airline checklist, it works with acute medicine, doesn't it? Because there are no questions to be asked. You're just trying to save somebody's life, and you've got to do the safest and the best, quickest way of doing that very often. And that kind of model of healthcare works in those scenarios, but it completely is useless in areas where there's a great deal of care and interaction and all those kind of things and responsiveness to the patient required.
Yes, very much so. I think these are two different areas of how we provide, how and where we provide care.
Mm-hmm.
And many patients with chronic diseases, they see their disease as a... They sometimes see their disease almost as a friend who teaches, the friend capable to teach them ways of living that are often different from when they first encountered difficulties with their health.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a learning aspect, there's a social aspect, there is a life readjustment aspect, and in a therapeutic intervention requires to be aware of many of these aspects, mm-hmm. and to give patients a say in that.
Right.
And to instead of just applying a imposed concept.
Right. So this is what they talk about a lot, of course, patient-centered care and patient choice, but they find very hard to do within the NHS. So far, they haven't really managed it. But anyway, you're saying this is what you do, and you feel that the health service is all the worse for not having that.
I feel the healthcare, and what I usually enjoyed and where I felt I learned most or a lot is in my young doctor years, by shadowing clinicians, which were role models for me, which I respected at the time.
So right.
There was this learning, this bedside learning, which allows a lot of psychological interaction with patients, and also learning the skills and the ropes from experienced clinicians. As far as I can say, I'm not so much in the learning environment, but I, from what I hear from young doctors and practitioners, there is not enough apprenticeship. There's more just online learning,
right?
Which I consider detached and separated out from reality and detached, and I consider it worth to have a look at for how physicians or how healthcare has provided good quality of service decades ago, and sometimes it would be important to review again these older concepts of healthcare.
You think in some ways it's becoming worse, becoming more abstract, the learning, and therefore more impersonal.
Certainly, it has become more impersonal and more product and technology driven, and there are huge industries now attached to modern healthcare. They need their service contracts fulfilled. They create a certain need of doing healthcare in a certain way, and that has to be fulfilled in a certain way. That has to be that almost dictates us
right
the way we can apply it to
anything but patient centered. In fact,
yeah. Well, to a certain degree, I would like to see patient groups being more and more empowered to have a say, to be encouraged to have a say, but an active say, not just kind of be heard and to fulfill hours of democratic obligations of everyone being heard, but with a real impact on how healthcare should in the future be shaped and innovated or renewed. And sometimes technology is very important and expenditure, but sometimes simple ways of caring and simple way of communication can achieve an awful lot.
So I think there really are only a few who can fully appreciate the enormity of what's involved in the survival of an integrative clinic in the UK for a whole decade. But it's hardly been a supportive environment for you to work in. But I'm just wondering, are there any ways in which you feel that the kind of establishment view has moved on to be more accommodating of integrative medicine?
Well, it's hard to say. I can see the intention is there, but I think everyone is moving very cautiously forward. I think I would like to, I'm projecting my, what I would like to see, and I have to be careful that I'm realistic. In the current situation, I don't see too much progress.
You don't at all.
I do see progress, but I would like to see more progress, sort of more from top down progress. It may not work that way. It may go the other way, from the grassroots to other levels. This I don't know. I'm an observer, and I see myself in the middle of it.
Right. Yeah. But you had to deal with, as you were saying earlier, the regulatory authorities very much, and they're the ones in the end who decide how far medicine can move, where, you know, the progress that's allowed. And certainly, you know, there's a lot more discussion, if you like, about integrative medicine than there ever was. But I'm just interested in, well, how does that translate into what you as a practitioner working out here are actually able to do?
Yeah, let's put it that way. I feel much more supported by very proactive patient groups who charities, cancer patient support charities, who show an active interest, who stage seminars, conferences. So there's a considerable educational need and activity that I feel is certainly happening. There's also a huge number of non-regulated practitioners, some of them very experienced across the UK, who would like to be appreciated and more integrated in for what they're doing.
Right.
They support many, many patients. There are millions of interventions, of healthcare interventions, which are not recorded or not statistically, not figure in any statistics. And in a larger survey, that would certainly come up as a relatively important factor that shouldn't be ignored. Many such practitioners, for example, they could be specialists in lymphatic drainage, they could be specialists in nutrition, specialists in herbal medicine, specialists in providing dressing, wound dressing support, etc. They like to be more sort of integrated and play a more active and recognized role.
Get referrals.
For referrals, but also to work more in with the so-called established clinicians. I think learning could go both ways.
Yes.
There's also government advisors on statutory regulations. Statutory regulation are currently trying to identify regulatory bodies and frameworks how to capture such treatment interventions and how to enable practitioners with skills but which don't fit into any precise category could be more part of all this.
Right. So it's kind of trying to grow the framework in a way to encompass more of this.
Yeah, it would help.
It would help enormously.
It would help enormously. If patients would like it, but also there are many practitioners who would like to be more involved and recognized.
More recognized, Okay, so you talked about it, you know, possibly being a grassroots thing. Do you think that, you know, again, having a kind of 10-year view of what you've done here, do you think, I'm talking about cancer patients particularly, do you see a growth in this kind of grassroots interest in looking outside of conventional medicine?
Certainly, there's a growth in grassroots interest. Cancer, the diagnosis, the early diagnosis of cancer has probably accelerated this interest, but also the self-help strategies that nowadays are available. And to understand cancer as not just a fait accompli, to understand cancer as more a metabolic deviation, we can understand it as a psychosomatic crisis. But the different concepts of understanding also enable a lot of different ways of treatment and living with cancer, and to make it more of a theme in life rather than a fatal destiny. I think this is a very important aspect. That we should consider, and it will revolutionize cancer treatments altogether.
Okay, well, we're going to finish there. Thank you very much indeed, Siggy, for showing me around the clinic, for talking about your work, and thank you for all that you do for patients here in our much-strapped nation where integrative medicine really isn't a thing yet.
Yes, I see it in a similar way, and thank you for your interest in coming to visit us, and to and it needs people like you who can identify that there's a huge need to accelerate the whole process of care in this challenging environment in which we live, which has huge opportunities if we understand them correctly and openly. Thank you.
Okay. So I'm sitting in the waiting area with Janet. Janet, would you like to tell us why you're here today?
Well, I've got Lyme disease.
Right.
And I've been seeing Dr. Chester since 1996.
Wow, okay.
And I come to him for everything. Because he is so brilliant and clever in a way that other doctors aren't.
Thinking outside the box, it's called, isn't it?
Yes.
Right. So he's been giving you a variety of treatments you wouldn't normally be able to get on the NHS?
Wouldn't be able to get any of them. In fact, I'd say he saved my life.
Well, that's a good testimony. Ever heard one? Thank you very much, Jenny. Thanks for listening today. Check the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk,
For links to material from today's show, just click the show logo that's on the homepage. And a quick reminder to check the Yes Life website or the Yes Life Facebook page if you're interested in our next event, Healing with Painting and Playing with Colour, on the 26th of September, or in joining the Yes Life 10K run on the 6th of October. Hope you can listen again next week. Goodbye. Thank you.